save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in one. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Ben Orland has been a guest on the show before. He got famous with a blog called Math with Bad Drawings, which is what it says on the tin. He teaches mathematics using his humble drawing skills. His last book was a smorgasbord of different mathematical topics, but he recently came out with a new book, Change is the Only Constant, The Wisdom of Calculus in a Madcap World, which focuses more on calculus itself. I'm Sophia, and...
And I'm Gabriel.
And you're listening to Breaking Math. And of course, we have on with us Ben Orland, author. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this is very, very exciting. Your second book. This is just really cool. I love that first book. It was so much fun. And I got to say, I was excited to see that that you chose calculus as a topic. I've had a conversation with my brother who got his bachelor's in applied math. He actually has talked about wanting to be a calc teacher specifically. This is the topic that made him fall in love with math. One of the questions I want to ask you is why you chose this topic specifically, and also as a follow-up, if there were other topics you considered but ultimately chose this.
Yeah, I think it was calculus from the start for me, actually. I think I knew even before writing the first book that when I did the follow-up, it was going to be about calculus. And the reason is that calculus sits at a very special place in the center of the American math curriculum in a way that it doesn't actually in every country. So I taught in the UK, and there, as in most countries, the math curriculum is just sort of integrated. Everything sort of sloshes together, and you'd learn a little bit. You know, you might learn to differentiate polynomials. In fact, we taught that to 9th and 10th graders, but sort of before they'd seen anything in the way of limits. It was just a very different sequence than we do in the US. Anyway, in the US, calculus sits in this kind of on this throne right there at the kind of the end of secondary school or the start of university. And it has, particularly has a reputation in the US as being this really fancy, exciting, scary subject. There are things I loved about it and things that I thought like, the reputation of calculus gets wrong. And so I thought it would be an interesting topic to engage with.
Wow. Yeah. I actually had no idea that math was taught substantially different from place to place. That's actually fascinating. That makes me, so many questions. I guess one question would be, do you have a preference for how it's taught, say, in the U.S. versus in England?
I think no winds up being the answer. It's funny because there are these very visible differences, like what order do you teach topics in and what's included in the curriculum, and those feel like they should be the determining factors. Like those just feel like such big factors from the outside. But then when you actually get inside a classroom, the things that wind up mattering are much more local. It's much more about, well, first of all, I mean, what's the relationship between the teacher and the students? Do they have a shared vision for what the students are learning? But also, you know, what are the moves that the teacher is making? What do the discussions look like in the class? What specific problems are the students working on? So it winds up being the things that make math education work or not work, I think, turn out to be very specific more than global.
And Ben, actually, before we go deeper into the book or the processes of creating the book, I'd love to ask you for our listeners, where can our listeners get a copy of your book and where can they read more about you and your work?
Yeah, no, yes, good point, right, before we get too far into the weeds. So the book is called Change is the Only Constant, and the subtitle is The Wisdom of Calculus in a Madcap World. And you can get it pretty much anywhere books are sold. I think they still have some we did a signed pre-orders through a store called Majors and Quinn, M-A-G-E-R-S and Quinn like the name. That's in Minnesota. They ship anywhere. I think they've still got some signed copies left, or you can get it anywhere books are sold. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, wherever you want it from.
Cool. Yeah, that's the world over, huh? Anyone in the world can, because they're very good at distributing, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They should be able to ship internationally too from Majors and Quinn.
Oh, fantastic. Next question I want to ask you again for our listeners. Who specifically is your target audience? Who would you recommend read your book?
Yeah, so the book, I think similar to the last one, actually. So Math with Bad Drawings, I wrote very much with a curious nonfiction reader in mind. I was picturing someone who's, you know, probably an adult, maybe has some vague memories of math in school that may or may not be fond. You know, a curious, intelligent person who isn't necessarily, let's say, steeped in mathematics, and somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about mathematics usually, and so wants a fun experience of the subject. So yeah, I think the new book is similar, I think, in that regard. It's meant for a very, I would say an intelligent, curious nonfiction reader with a sense of humor.
Yeah, I noticed that your book was actually like probably simple enough for like a third grader like to read it and get like quite a bit out of it. Some of the stuff, I think on page like 80 some, where you start talking about like dimensionality, is like something that'd be a little bit more difficult to get across to like a young person from the book. But I mean, I was pretty like in awe of like how well it explained concept. And also I laughed on page 44 when you talked about the second derivative of happiness in your experience in England. Would you like to talk about that at all?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, yeah, thanks. I'm glad that it strikes you as accessible. That's definitely something that was really fun with the first book. Actually, I was getting a lot of emails from parents who were saying, you know, I got this book for myself, or I got it for my teenage kid. And then my 12-year-old or my 10-year-old got a hold of it and was enjoying it a lot. That makes me really happy to hear. I think certainly the fact that I'm a teacher and enjoy working with kids, hopefully, I guess, winds up inflecting the books a little bit. Yeah, so I certainly hope that the calculus book can work that way too. I think the pictures help. The pictures are a nice place for the adult reader to rest their eyes, hopefully, and then to make things a little more vivid and easy to follow. But I think also have hopefully the nice side effect of engaging younger readers too. Right. So then the one you mentioned, the second derivative of happiness, right? That was what you were wanting to bring up. Yeah, so that was actually a fun. I mean, in some ways, that conversation that grew out of is sort of emblematic of the book. This is while I was teaching in the UK, and I had a friend James who was an English teacher, and he's just a very curious guy. He's very happy to talk about pretty much anything, and so he hadn't taken math since junior senior year of high school, but we got to talking at some point where he was describing the shifting of his happiness. He was trying to find language to describe. We were just sitting around chatting, having tea, because it's the UK, this is what you do. And he was trying to find some language to describe the changes in his happiness over time. He's like, well, things have been getting better, but they weren't so good a couple weeks ago, and now they're getting better, but maybe are they getting better faster? And he was sort of straining for language that I recognized, because I was about to walk out the door and teach calculus in a few minutes. Language that I recognize as derivatives. He was trying to describe rates of change. And so that wound up being that's I think chapter 3 in the book, just sort of unpacking that conversation and using the derivative, which is usually used to describe stuff we have data for. You use derivatives to describe physical motion or to describe inflation in an economy, or things like that, where we have some real computations we can do. But applying those same ideas of a derivative is just a rate of change, with how fast something is changing and whether it's growing or shrinking, applying that to something much fuzzier, like emotions, how happy you're feeling.
Yeah. And when you mentioned that, it strikes me that calculus has been around formally for something like 350 years, and still we don't have most people using general calculus terminology.
Yeah, that's right. It's strange because the derivative really isn't so elusive a concept. You can make it really tricky if you want, right? So the way the derivative is often introduced is you say, okay, we want to know how something is changing at a particular moment, right? Like we want to know how fast a car is going right this instant. Mm-hmm. And then you immediately get into this lovely little paradox where you're like, well, how fast is the car going right this instant? Well, let's do a freeze frame on the car to see how fast it's going. Well, if you do a freeze frame, the car is not moving anymore. So it's very hard to say how fast it's going. The sort of speed kind of loses its meaning when you look at a single moment. Anyway, and that's to a certain degree, that's the way I present the derivative in the book. And that's often the way it's presented to students. It's kind of this difficult concept that comes, the only way to understand it properly is through the careful development of the language of limits. And so I think that's why the language of calculus hasn't particularly penetrated and spread and isn't a universal inheritance for students, because we often hide it behind this kind of paywall of algebra and limits and some sort of tricky conceptual frameworks. But as you're saying, just a rate of change and how is the rate of change changing, which is the second derivative, those are actually pretty handy just everyday ideas.
You had mentioned Second Derivative. Real quick, I wanted to share some... I don't remember if we had discussed this on the previous episode. If we did, we can edit this out. But there was a fun fact I learned about derivatives. And I'm sure by now you may be aware of this fact. So, of course, if we talk about a position as our original... what am I trying to say here? If we start with position, right?
It's a function of time.
A function of time. Position is a function of time. Then the first derivative of position is, of course, speed.
Velocity.
Thank you. Good Lord. Early in the morning for me. Sorry. As a former teacher, I should have got that.
Velocity, of course, for our listeners being positive or negative, speed only being positive.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then the derivative of velocity is, of course, acceleration. And then this is where things get a little funny. The derivative of acceleration is, what do you guys know of it?
Right. Jerk.
Jerk, correct. And the derivative of jerk is?
See, this is where I lose. I can't go past jerk, right? So jerk is our third derivative. So I don't know the name for the fourth derivative.
Okay. Snap, crackle, pop are the next three.
Yeah, correct. Correct. That's literally what it is. So that shows that mathematicians do have humor as well. Now, in all of my studies of physics, and they're not entirely extensive, they are as much as a graduate student of engineering would study, I've never even used jerk, for instance. So I'm not sure why those exist. I mean, conceptually, they, you know, however fast, whatever level you're on, however fast that is changing. So I guess it could go on arbitrarily, but it is true that the terminologies chosen are snap and then crackle and then pop. So fun little trivia there.
Right. No, I like that. Yeah. Right. It seems like at least in a calculus one course, if you're going to be taking more than two derivatives, you might as well be taking infinite derivatives. You know, yeah. You may be talking about, something like sine or cosine, where you have this, you know, the derivative starts repeating after some number of derivatives. You know where I saw the third derivative recently? I'm not going to remember the details of it, but I was reading the book, which is a collection of quanta pieces about mathematics. So I'm blanking on the name right now.
About mathematics?
So Quanta is a publication that's maybe 5 years old or so, 5 or 6 years old, and which does a lot of really interesting reporting. They have some excellent writers who write for them. It does a lot of reporting on math and science, and particularly focuses on trying to do really honest, rich math and science reporting. You know, I think almost every publication out there, you know, the New York Times will sort of try to write pieces about it. If there's a really groundbreaking once or twice a decade kind of mathematical development, they might try to write a piece about it. But there's very few publications actually making an effort to cover news in research mathematics. And Quanta is really the best and to some degree the only source for that kind of news. Anyway, but there's a handful of pieces in there that are about, I'm sure I'm going to botch this in the telling, but are about a sort of distribution that shows up in a lot of settings. Sort of anywhere you have a system that's kind of loosely connected. I'm trying to remember where, you know, sort of like the way buses might interact. If you have bus drivers trying to be careful not to have their bus arrive too soon after the last bus. Then there's some physical systems like this. Anyway, somewhere deep within this chapter, you wind up with a third derivative being the thing you need to describe sort of the differential equation that drives these systems.
Interesting. And I did like about your book was the chapter where you go, I have a couple of questions relating to this in a second, but it was the whole thing where it was like the chain rule, and not just the chain rule, but you were saying like the machine that creates pictures out of formulas, and I would create like a grid for multiplication and for squaring, it would do some other thing. And
yeah, this chapter was inspired by a short story by a writer named Margaret St. Clair, who wrote, I've only read a few of her stories, but she wrote this collection of stories in the maybe late 40s, early 50s, that were about this this like sort of couple of the future, called Una is the girl and Jick is the guy. Jick, I think, is a great name for a guy who, you know, is not going to be 100% sympathetic, just like Jick. I'm not on board with a Jick. Anyway, so it's this sci-fi story is about this futuristic couple, and they're sort of playing out these like domestic disputes and little squabbles. There's like a lot of the stories are largely about like appliances of the future. Anyway, and so one of the stories is about Jick, who's always trying to teach Una the math that he's enjoying and is curious about, brings home this this mathematical visualizer machine, which is supposed to help you see any kind of mathematical idea. You put in an equation and it'll show you what it means. which is sort of a funny story to read in 2019, because we sort of have that. I mean, we have Desmos, we have Wolfram Alpha. Like, we really actually have some tools in a way that St. Clair couldn't have necessarily, well, she did foresee, but could never have experienced herself when she was writing these stories. We actually do have magical math visualization machines. And so anyway, what I write about in that chapter is the visualizations that they come up with to understand these calculus ideas. And what's strange about it is that these aren't visuals that show up in all that many calculus classes. Mm-hmm. We tend to do it just purely based on symbols and formalism in calculus. And so it's strange that even though the technological environment has advanced tremendously, we're teaching it kind of the same way that St. Clair was thinking of in 1950 or whenever it was.
Now we have a few questions that are just like, just kind of more open-ended questions based on the sort of things that are in your book. So the book, the section on the biography of a fad, was that the name of the chapter?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Where you talk about exponential growth and logistic growth. Exponential being like compound interest, and logistic being like a chemical reaction. First question is, could you explain just real quick what those are? And second of all, Moore's law, do you know how that might relate to which way you would classify that and which makes the most physical sense?
Yeah, so in that chapter, right, what I wanted to do was sort of explore a really simple mathematical model for how a fad might work. And so basically the model that you come up with is what's called the logistic growth curve, where basically the idea is it starts out growing quite shallowly, but actually at a pretty high percentage rate. So you're starting from almost zero, but it's actually growing pretty fast if you look at it as a percentage. And then it continues to grow and grow and grow. And so you look at the graph and it's kind of growing steeper and steeper and steeper. At some point you hit a rate of maximum growth, and then it starts to level out. So that to me is a pretty good, you think about what a fad is, and that's what a fad is, right? It starts out small. It's not popular. It gets popular. It hits some point of like maximum hype. And then it starts to level out and fewer people are hopping on board to the fad. So I think you could draw graphs like that for, Rubik's cubes were huge in the 1980s, or like Beanie Babies in the 1990s, or, it doesn't have to be toys, sort of anything, the musical artist or whatever you pick. So I sort of liked that and there's a simple differential equation to describe this. So I liked logistic growth as kind of a simple model of how fads work. Right, so you brought up Moore's law, which is, well, let's get into that in a second, actually. The trick with logistic growth, of course, is that at the beginning, it looks a lot like exponential growth. It looks like the growth is getting faster and faster and faster the way that exponential growth does. And the problem, right, I guess what's tricky about it in practice is that exponential growth sort of can't last forever. Right, like almost by definition, in a universe with finite resources, things that look like they're growing exponentially just can't. I remember doing this with students in like 2010, 2011. I would show them data from Facebook, their number of users from like 2004 to 2008, and it fit an exponential growth curve almost perfectly. It was an incredibly good model, actually, because Facebook had gone from a few million users to tens of millions to, at that point, I think around a billion. So it looked almost perfectly exponential. And of course, it hasn't been since then. They've, leveled off at 2.5 billion because, there's only so many people with internet access. So everything, even if it looks exponential for a while, has to run into constraints. We live in a finite universe.
Yeah. I always think that's interesting. I don't know why logistic and exponential is always fascinating me, but I thought I enjoyed that chapter quite a bit. And the second chapter I wanted to ask you about has to do with limits, and why does d of x squared kind of tend to disappear if you do calculus, like, using just d of x's and multiplying it out straight?
Right, yeah. So this is a good, maybe it's good to give some backdrop on how calculus is usually taught, sort of how it's structured, which is, what are the problems you're looking at in calculus? Like we talked about before, it's rates of change. It's a lot of things happening, an action that's unfolding over a tiny instant, a fraction of a second. Or it's a physical process that's unfolding over a tiny, tiny bit of space or something like that. And so the way calculus is sort of universally taught is you develop this idea of a limit, and it has this fancy notation that goes along with it. And then what that lets you do once you develop that notation and sort of play out the consequences of it is it lets you plug in algebraic formulas and manipulate them very carefully, and you should get the right answers even if you don't totally know what limits are or why they work or what's going on. So I definitely didn't want it in a book full of cartoons, you know, that's meant for a general readership. I definitely didn't want to be trotting the reader through a lot of a limit notation. So what I was hoping to do was come up with, you know, when I wanted to explain a concept, to come up with a good visual language for that. And the one that's out there is obviously not something I devised. It's something that's been, you know, part of calculus since it was developed, is to kind of think about little shapes, little rectangles. So for example, take a square, right? So, you know, we know that if you've taken calculus, you know, the derivative of x squared is 2x. That's one of the first facts you learn in calculus. Mm-hmm. And so what does that mean? Well, it means if you take a square and say it has side length x, so x could be 5 or 6 or whatever, it's 5 by 5 square, 6 by 6 square. And then you imagine that square growing just a little bit. Imagine x getting a little bigger. So it goes from 5 to 5.001. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, how much is the square growing by? And basically, you're going to have, I'm picturing it kind of growing to the right and up. So I'll have a little bit of strip to the right and a little kind of strip at the top where it's growing. And then up in the corner, there's like this tiny, tiny little extra square up in the upper right-hand corner where it's grown as well. But that's so much smaller than the strips that you don't even really need to take it into account in your calculations.
Yeah, it always seems like you'd be subtracting a strip from a square, which is just a square.
Yeah, I think that's another way to think of it, yeah.
Which is weird because you're dealing with like the individual little like layers of square as it is. So it's always fun to me just to realize what level of infinitesimal that you're dealing with and how it all, yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. There's a great, so there's this book that kind of makes the rounds on the internet sometimes from the early 20th century called Calculus Made Easy. I think it's Sylvanus Thompson, I think is the author. And so it's this textbook from, I think the first edition was 1910 or 1913. But the funny thing about it is it reads beautifully now. It's actually totally accessible and in some ways better than, you know, modern calculus textbooks that you'll see. And one of the very first chapters is called On Different Degrees of Smallness.
Oh, nice.
With the point being that, you know, sort of like we're trying to have this conversation in terms of geometry, but you can think of it in terms of, say, time, where if you're talking about millennia, right, if you're a historian who or archaeologist who thinks in terms of millennia, then 1 year is almost a negligible. It's like a rounding error, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a modern political historian, years are pretty significant, but 1 week is kind of a rounding error.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're planning, I don't know, if you're like planning out your year, you guys are planning, you know, which guests to have on which podcast episodes and what topics you want to cover. Like a week is not a rounding error. A week is pretty important, but, you know, an hour is a rounding error, you know, when you schedule the podcast for two or three. Anyway, so depending what scale you're looking at, different things look big and look small, which is, of course, not a shocking truth, but turns out to be one of the kind of key ideas that's in the engine of calculus.
Yeah, and speaking of the engine of calculus, you went into one optimizing problem, the one with the optimal sized city being made out of strips of ox. If I remember correctly, the ox was cut into 60 strips, and the strips were used to outline a city. It was based on some real thing.
Yeah. So this is a story. This is one of those ones that kind of circulates as folklore in math departments. So I don't remember who and I'm sure I heard it from my wife first, but I don't know where she heard it from. But this is a story that's actually in the Aeneid by Virgil, or at least is sort of alluded to in the Aeneid. And the idea is that an exiled princess named Alyssa, I think in the original versions, shows up on the Mediterranean coast, sort of the northern shore of Africa, and somehow manages to negotiate. I don't quite understand what these negotiations would have looked like. Managed to negotiate for as much land to keep for herself as she can cover with an ox hide, which I've never been in a situation where that was close to happening to me. I don't know what the alternatives were. Like as much land you can cover with some.
2/3 of my transactions are ox hide based.
That makes sense. Yeah. So I spent some time in New Mexico, but I haven't been there in a little bit. So that must be what it is. And usually I'm in Santa Fe, not Albuquerque. Next time I'm in Albuquerque. Right. So anyway, so they wind up in this ox hide situation where Alyssa has a piece of oxide, and she gets as much land as it can cover. So, you know, who knows what language this negotiation was unfolding in, but she decides to interpret it a little loosely as, rather than how much land can she cover with an oxide, it's how much land can she encircle with an oxide. So she's going to cut the oxide into little strips, you know, like thread almost, like rope, and then arrange the rope so that she can cover, you know, she can enclose more land. I guess the idea being that, like, if she were to cover, it sort of makes sense, right? Like, it would be very weird if she arranges it in a giant circle. It would be very weird to give her a circular strip, but she doesn't get the land inside the circle, right? Mm-hmm. That's still there. So anyway, it would be a strange shaped country. Anyway, so then the problem is basically, and this is something that a simpler version of this you do in every intro calculus course, is what's the best you can do with this rope? You know, you've got some amount of rope. And what's the best area, you know, what's the biggest area that you can close off using that rope?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that, the problem, I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with the calculus of variations, but I thought that maybe when we're on optimizing problems, wanted to know if you have any future books that might have calculus of variations in them or...
Yeah, this one actually, both of the optimization problems that I discuss in this book sort of do lend themselves a little better to calculus of variations. So this one, the one with Alyssa and the rope, the version I discuss in the book is mostly just assuming she's going to do a rectangle, because that's the one that an introductory calculus student can do, and that's the one that's a little easier to kind of graph and make sense of. So you sort of think about different rectangles she could arrange it in, and if you play around with it, and I've done experiments like this, you know, with middle schoolers. You know, a long, thin rectangle is a very bad idea because you're spending all your rope on kind of the long dimension. The long dimension is not helping you very much. Every extra little bit in the long dimension is not buying you very much extra area. So you really should be investing more in the short dimension of the rectangle. So long, skinny rectangles are bad. And it turns out the best rectangle, which is not a huge surprise, is a square. And then where it gets interesting is where you, and this is again what you tend to do in a calculus course, is if you, instead of building it out in the open space, you build it along the water, where since one of the walls is now made of the beach, you only need to build three walls, you know, two coming away from the beach and one parallel to the beach. And that actually totally changes the solution. A square is no longer the best you can do, because you're sort of spending extra rope building away from the beach, you know, with those two walls, when it would be easier to just build longer along the beach because you only have to use one little scrap of rope to build along the beach. Those can all be that's still just using rectangles, though. So if you want to talk about all shapes, then you need calculus of variations.
In the book, it wasn't a semicircle.
It's sort of a sleight of hand. I give the solution that's the rectangle solution, and then I think in a sentence or two I say, well, and you could actually do even better, which would be a semicircle. I don't actually go through that because it would take calculus of variations. So that was something. One of the pleasures of getting to do a book like this that's full of cartoons is you can make all kinds of leaps that you couldn't make in a class. If I did that for some students, they'd be like, wait, where'd the semicircle come from? Show me the equations. How did you do it? And it would be like technically it would be too hard. The students wouldn't have the techniques to take those derivatives and to solve it in this more general form of calculus. But in a book, I could, you know, the idea makes sense. So all I really need to do is lead the reader through the concepts.
So as a former middle school math teacher, I never taught calculus, but I know that calculus itself in the American system is split up into several skills that are spread throughout calculus one and calculus two and calculus three. There are so many things. Obviously, there's the fundamental theorem of calculus. There is something that we will talk about called the chain rule. There's what else? It's been a while since I've done Calc 1.
That's it. It's just those two things, actually. I don't know how they drag it out so long.
Yeah. So we, you know, of course, we got real inspired reading your book, and we thought, well, let's try to think of our own clever analogies to describe some of these components of calculus for somebody who has never been in calculus. And I'm always going to use, you know, my nieces and nephews who are between the ages of 3 and 14 right now, and none of them have had calculus yet. So, you know, I think with chain rule, first I have to explain to them what it is. And for our listeners as well, but then explain our analogy and how it illustrates it. And actually, I shouldn't say ours, because Sophia, you thought of all of this.
Yeah, so I just thought it'd be fun because I know that you come up with a lot of the happiness thing was really what inspired me to do this. But so we have f of g of x, where f is the sound wave frequency on a record, And G is the number of rotations and radians of the record. And then F of G of T, of course, would be the frequency that the needle makes when it's sweeping the record at that point. And you know that its derivative must be proportional to the derivative of the speed of the sweeper, because if the pitch is constant on the record, then if the speed doesn't change, then the pitch doesn't change. So that checks out. And it must be proportional to the derivative of F at G of T, which would be the sound at the position that the needle would be at time T. Because if the speed that it's moving around is constant, then it's only the etchings on the record that contribute to the final pitch. So then you get F of G prime of X is equal to G prime of X times F prime of G of X.
Now, real quick, I wanted to explain, again, what we didn't say quite yet was for our listeners who had never even heard of the chain rule. The chain rule is when you have a function, like a function of a function, like Russian dolls almost, right? And again, as you said, so like if you start off with the function g of x, you know, g of x, for those who are in algebra, they know that it means you do something to x, you know, it could be anything at all. But then the Russian doll part happens when you have another function of that function. So you do something to the process that's doing something to x. And then when you take a derivative of that, that requires the chain rule. I'm trying to think about how I'd...
Oh, yeah. And this is one question that I have Ben, with your experience, like making things really accessible, like especially with all your work on calculus, how might you improve that analogy, putting you on the spot?
I like the analogy a lot. I got to think it through more, but I think having a concrete physical system where we're talking about, where we've got two functions that are very clearly meaningful. And so we can think of the chain rule as, I think where the chain rule gets tricky, as with a lot of things in math and in calculus particularly, is when it's very decontextualized. Mm. And so you're learning it as a rule about symbols, basically, rather than a rule about objects or physical systems. And this is, a lot of what happens in math class is you've got people who enjoy learning rules about how to manipulate symbols and people who don't enjoy that. And one can enjoy it for a variety of reasons or not enjoy it for a variety of reasons. But math class winds up separating people into those who enjoy these symbol manipulation procedures and those who are not on board for it. So I think having physical illustrations for why those rules are true or why at least they might be true or seem intuitive to try to build some intuition for them is definitely a big part of teaching.
Nice. I think what we'll probably do is send you the written form of what we just told you about explaining the chain rule using sound and a record player. Oh, also, as you had mentioned earlier, it's very important to say that the record wouldn't be like a song. It would be a monotone.
No, it would be a song. It's just that if it were a monotone, then it demonstrates that is proportional to G prime.
Okay, got it. Yeah, that one certainly takes some sussing out, but it's a fun analogy. Now, how about we try, I'll go ahead and toss you this one, if you can explain an analogy with UV substitution. Go for it.
substitution being, right.
We're kidding.
Right, okay.
We spent a long time trying to think of a story or an analogy or something that would explain use. Dude, we failed. That's not possible to do on a, well, I shouldn't say that. I should challenge her.
We haven't proven that it's possible.
That's correct. Thank you. For our listeners, if anyone can think of a cool story or an analogy to explain use substitution to a middle schooler, please send it to us. We'd love to hear it.
Right. Yeah. I think one way, this doesn't capture the whole breadth of U substitution, but I think even in like algebra one, you run into situations where relabeling your variable makes things easier.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at the equation you're trying to solve is 2x plus 1 plus 5 groups of 2x plus 1 plus 20 groups of 2x plus 1 equals 17 groups of 2x plus 1 minus 4 or something, right? Like if you keep having the same thing appear over and over, it would be easier just to take 2x plus 1 and call it y or call it t or something. So to some extent, U substitution, this doesn't capture the geometry of it, but you can think of it as just relabeling.
Yeah,
And relabeling is something we do across mathematics.
And that obviously can get very complex. Like, I mean, even just in regular algebra, like You've seen the derivation of the cubic, right? The general cubic.
At some point, yeah, I certainly couldn't reproduce it.
At one point, you replace one of the variables with w cubed minus 3 over w cubed or something like that.
Mm.
It's pretty insane. Or 1 over w cubed. Now it's time for Find the Calculus, a game show where we tell you random things and you have to tell us how calculus relates to them. You win as many points as you win.
Okay, infinitesimal quantities of points, I presume.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the jig's up, but yeah, I guess we'll continue. But no, just kidding. But okay, a kayak that has to avoid whirlpools.
Oh, interesting. A kayak that has to avoid whirlpools. Right. I mean, whirlpools, if I were, I feel like I'm not, my multivariable is not at the top of my my brain right now, because the book is mostly about single variable calculus. But a whirlpool is essentially a sink, right? It's like, if you think about this two-dimensional world of the water, the surface of the water, the whirlpool stuff swirls around it and then gradually narrows in, you know, sort of, you know, think of it almost like a black hole in the whirlpool. So, you know, that's it. Obviously, actual whirlpools are vastly more complicated than that. But that's the first thing that comes to mind for me is basically you're navigating a vector field, mm-hmm. right? Where every point in the water is pushing you a certain direction. And that's definitely a calculus problem.
Awesome. Now, how about a garden infested by termites?
Garden infested by termites. Well, here clearly we're talking about population growth, right? And so, you know, how do we model population growth? Well, we, with some differential equations, and we hope that our termite infestation has already hit the logistic growth curve is already maxed out, you know, as opposed to having more exponential growth left to do.
Mm. Osmosis.
Osmosis. Interesting. Huh. Right. So osmosis, we're talking about, right, concentrations. When I like to think back to my high school chemistry. So we're talking about where you have, more salt on one side of a membrane than the other side, but the salt can't move across the membrane. So instead the water moves across the membrane to make things, to reach equilibrium. And I don't know the differential equations that you would write down for this, but it's, to some extent, this is a cheating answer, because everything in the universe can probably be described with some differential equation or another, you know, whether you can solve it or not. But certainly there should be laws, you know, equations governing how the exchange of materials across that boundary.
Yeah, and one maybe thing to remark upon is that the differential equations that you have in your book are very simple ones, and that obviously they get way more complex, but like, it always struck me how like much complexer you get even out of the simple ones.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I definitely, in the book, I try to find stuff that's, right. I know, you know, a lot of your listeners obviously are people who are already quite invested in math and curious about math. And so I try, even though I'm writing to be accessible to an audience that doesn't, that isn't familiar with calculus, maybe never even took calculus. The very much who I want the book to be accessible to. Mm-hmm. I think for those who have taken calculus and do know calculus, there's still some, you know, there should be lots of interesting, new, different connections.
Yeah. Evel Knievel.
Evel Knievel, right. I mean, clearly he's just, you know, as he's going down the ramp, clearly it's just all equations in his mind. You know, he's just calculating derivatives and integrals left and right. Projectile motion is one of the sort of elegant early applications of calculus. Mm-hmm. So thinking about, what you can do with calculus is you can start from the idea that an object flying through the air, yeah, as always, we ignore air resistance. Gravity is the only force acting on that object. There's a constant acceleration due to gravity as it accelerates downward. And then from there, you know, with some data, you can figure out the trajectory over time.
Awesome. Now we just have two more, and we might cut a few of these out just for whatever, but I think it's good to have data more than not have data. Baking souffle.
Baking a souffle. I would love to know how to bake a souffle. They're really delicate, right? They collapse if you make any noise, or is that just cartoons?
I think they collapse if you change the temperature too much in the oven. Like, it has to be a very constant temperature, and the volume increases for a very long time, and has like a certain softness to it.
Okay, cool.
Until it like hardens up. So
that sounds good. That sounds right. I guess, come to think of it, my experience with soufflés is 90% through cartoons, 10% through an episode of British Bake Off that I saw in the last year. So what do they have to do with calculus? I would say soufflés are delicious, as is calculus.
Okay, we're gonna end with that one.
Should we give points for creativity, or
you get a whole point.
Wait a minute,
plus an infinitesimal unit.
Isn't there a calculus problem like Gabriel's horn or something like that, where one thing goes to zero, but then something else goes to infinity, where the actual relevance goes to zero, but the creativity goes to infinity? So
I'll take that. Yeah, right. And the named in your honor. So
yeah, and then if you just take a Dirac delta function, or is that it, the one where that still turns into one point after all?
Although I do think that Gabriel's horn is the function that when it's rotated around what is like put in a lathe around the x-axis, it has finite volume but infinite surface area.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Gabriel's horn is actually one of the last chapters in the book is about Gabriel's horn. Yeah, which is this cool shape that has the feature. It's sort of this infinitely long, spindly looking thing that stretches, is 3D shape stretching all the way down the x-axis forever and ever. And it has the weird property that it has finite volume but infinite surface area, which is to say, since it has finite volume, one could imagine filling it with paint, you know, because that's what volume is, right? Paint fills up some volume. But because it has infinite surface area, you could never paint it.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy.
Which is a weird, anyway, the one of the chapters in the book is sort of about trying to unpack that paradox and explain why it's not quite as paradoxical as it sounds.
But if they want to find that, they can find it in your book, and they can find that where?
Anywhere, yeah. So change is the only constant. The wisdom of calculus in a madcap world. Ben Orland is me. I'm the author and also the illustrator. So there's a lot of very bad cartoons in there.
What's your favorite cartoon in the book?
Oh, good question. Let me think. Let me grab the book. So one that I remember enjoying was drawing. There's a chapter about Sherlock Holmes, because there's this story where he tries to solve this problem involving a bicycle and gets it wrong. And it turns out actually by thinking about tangent lines, you can solve the problem. Anyway, Sherlock Holmes is really fun to draw because Sherlock Holmes is basically a person holding a magnifying glass and with a weird hat on. Oh no, holding a pipe. I'm sorry. Yes, that's how I always draw him, is with a pipe. So pipes are pretty fun to draw, and his weird hat is fun to draw. I only do stick figures. I have very limited drawing skills. So I would say drawing Sherlock Holmes is probably my highlight.
Let's see, we asked you, do you want to plug your Twitter, your website?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So my blog is Math with Bad Drawings, just mathwithbaddrawings.com. You can follow it on Facebook. There's, I don't know, like 20,000 people following it on Facebook, and I post cartoons there. Facebook's algorithm basically refuses to show you links to the blog, but will show you cartoons. So if you follow it on Facebook, you'll see some cartoons. And if you follow me on Twitter, I'm just Ben Orlin on Twitter, BNORLIN. And there I post cartoons and links to blog posts and try to share other people's work. Because there's actually, if you're not on Twitter, there's actually a really lovely math and math education community on Twitter, which, you know, Twitter has its drawbacks, but also has introduced me to a lot of really wonderful writers and creators and interesting people.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ben. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, no, Gabriel and Sophia, thank you both so much.